This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's a Friday. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. How are you today, George?
It's a wet Friday.
It is indeed.
Very wet. And also we're excited. We're getting closer to the end of the year.
It is. We're about 3 weeks away, isn't
That's
it?
That's right. Yeah. Festivity.
Christmas round the corner.
Absolutely. Mm. Time to put on weight and time to think of all sorts of good causes and charity.
Make resolutions, which we hopefully keep by March at least.
I just need to have resolutions to have more facial hair, that's all. But it's not happening.
No, it's not.
No.
I told you you're the wrong race, George.
Absolutely.
Okay, so joining us today, it was, you know, in conjunction with International Day of Disabled Persons, which is the 3rd of December, we highlighted one rare disease that doesn't get enough attention, which is spinal muscular atrophy. Mm-hmm. So joining us today is Edmund Lim. He's the founder of our patient advocacy group, We Care Journey, it's called. And he's also a parent of a child with what we call spinal muscular atrophy. He's in the studio with us to help us understand this disease a little bit better. There have been some allocations in the budget 2019 for rare diseases. Also, very recently, the MOH was reviewing the patient access scheme, and it sort of affected people with rare diseases because, you know, the cost of treatment is very, very costly. So it did affect a lot of people directly. I want to know the status of that.
Yeah.
So welcome to the show, Edmund. How are you today?
Hi, good, thanks. Thank you, Vera.
Tell us very quickly about We Care Journey, Edmund. What's that all about?
We Care Journey is an organisation where, under a registered persatuan, what we provide is care and support for families with spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA. It's the number one genetic cause of death for infants. So, and SMA diagnosis, as most people might expect, it is very overwhelming. It was for us when we had our son diagnosed a couple of years ago. So with We Care Journey, what we want to do is to give patients and families the information or resources that we believe they need to actually live, you know, engaged, active and hopeful lives today.
Okay. Tell us about your son, Brendan. Edmund, can you just share that journey with us? When did you find out Brendan actually had spinal muscular atrophy? And just share that journey with us.
We had, so when Brandon was born, he was actually in the intensive care. So at that time, you know, it was a difficult early days. After a couple of months, though, his development was delayed. So we have an older boy. So we have some sort of benchmark in terms of expecting how his milestone is going to be. When we spoke to our doctors, as many doctors say, well, boy's a bit slow, right? So we thought nothing of it, but we did start him on therapy from about 5 to 6 months on, right?
So therapy we started for?
Sorry?
What sort of therapy?
Physical therapy.
Okay. Yeah, so he wasn't growing physically? He wasn't...
Meeting his movement milestones.
Okay.
So we're still growing.
I mean,
so,
what were the specific things that you and your wife noticed that was slightly different between this child and your older child?
Firstly, he was a lot more relaxed. So we thought, so much more relaxed, this boy, right? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, right? He was just... wasn't personality. He was just, you know, he wasn't moving as much.
His muscles were a bit more floppy.
Correct. So floppy. And then he wasn't able to turn. He wasn't able to lift his head. And then we realized, well, something's not right. So that's why we started him on physical therapy. Mm-hmm. So physical therapy sort of seemed to help for a while. And then close to about 1 year, when he was about 1 year old, he started to not thrive, which means he wasn't growing anymore, right? He wasn't showing any development. So thanks to Google, right, you really can find a lot of information. So when Dr. George said floppy, you search for floppy, it tells you hypotonia, we search for hypotonia, and then you can slowly whittle down from thousands of things, right, looking at other symptoms and figure out for yourself, oh my God, it could be a couple of these things. That's when we approached our pediatrician, and my wife did, right? I was overseas at the time, to say, look, I'm concerned. I'm sufficiently concerned. I want to see someone else. And she got a referral to a geneticist. It was then they decided to have a couple of tests, and it came back positive for SMA. Mm-hmm. We're very lucky, right? Because actually with many rare diseases, they can spend years trying to figure out what it is, right? And not knowing what they're dealing with. So in that sense, we're lucky that when we did the first diagnosis, we got it right.
What is SMA? Can you explain to us?
Spinal muscular atrophy, it's a degenerative genetic disease. So genetic, it's passed down from the parents. And what happens is that we've got motor neurons in our spine, in the mm-hmm. spinal cord. So for patients like Brandon, these motor neurons are dying off. Mm-hmm. And because they're dying off, the signals from his brain in terms of wanting to move, it's not reaching the muscles. Mm-hmm. So that then causes, of course, movement limitations. At the same time, because the muscles aren't being used, they atrophy.
Yeah, they basically degenerate. And then, degenerate. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And obviously, it came as a shock to you. I mean, like you said, on one hand, many people just went around town trying to look for the diagnosis and never really find diagnosis for years. On the other hand, with the help of intensive research, background research, you managed to find a diagnosis. You know, on one hand, you're relieved that we know exactly why Brandon was like that. How do you feel when you got that news that the genetics diagnosis was there in front of you? And presumably that's at like nearly 100% accurate, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very accurate, the test. You know, like any parent, if you hear that your child is terminally ill, I think you sort of already know what it feels like. So we were sort of prepared for that because as you're sort of heading up to getting the confirmation, you already sort of see that coming, right? And literally, it feels like your whole life sort of falls apart, mm. right? Because, you know, everything you expected, you're thrown to a completely other direction and you're sort of not sure where you're headed. What made it more difficult, I feel, and that's why we set up WeCare Journey, was that when we then started to see many doctors, right, you sort of get a shrug of the shoulders. But when you contrast that to what you find on the internet, and I spent a week sort of researching this right after the diagnosis, I came back with a fat file, right, in terms of all the things that we should be doing, or the interventions, or the machines, mm-hmm. or the protocols. And then when you contrast to what it's like in Malaysia, you don't see that. That, for me, was frustrating. Right?
So because, how did you deal with that then? Who did you see, and you know, how did you get going with attending to Brandon, and what should be done?
You have to see many doctors. Right. And the doctors who would help are the ones that you would work with. It's not because the other doctors don't want to help, right? Just because there's so many diseases out there, not everyone's going to have the time or the capacity to actually deal with a rare disease. So you have to look for a doctor that has a certain level of passion. Mm-hmm. And interests and capacity to actually work with you in a rare disease like SMA. So when you find that doctor, those are the ones that you work with. And I think the really good doctors are the ones that also understand that, you know, for us as a parent, we deal with one disease. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it.
Yes.
And we can spend all our time dealing with one disease. Whereas for a doctor, you're going to be dealing with hundreds and hundreds of different types of cases and day in, day out. So the doctors would then sort of work with you to say that, okay, you really are able to focus and concentrate on one thing, but we don't have the medical qualifications. So both sides then sort of need to work together to figure out, you know, what's going to be the best thing mm-hmm. that we can actually do for our child.
You know, when you see a rare disease, it's the statistics show that one baby is born with SMA at least every fortnight. That's once every 2 weeks.
Yeah. And it's really good. We had this data recently. This is data from Malaysia. And what it's shown is that it's at least one baby every fortnight. And I use the word at least because these are confirmed tests that we have from the genetic testing centers.
Many, many babies presumably never really got round to having the accurate diagnosis.
Yeah, exactly, Dr. George. So mm-hmm. there'll be ones which are undiagnosed or ones which have passed away before diagnosis and the ones which are completely misdiagnosed.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, once every fortnight, that will translate to about 170 or to 200 babies per year. Is it because,
20 odd.
Yeah. One every fortnight. Oh, yeah, 26. Yeah. Okay. So how.
George, your math is deteriorating.
My brain's deteriorating.
Really?
So, I'm embarrassed. I'm red faced at the moment. So, I mean.
Because you always make fun of me and you tell me my math is bad.
It's raining outside. It's a bit cold. So is it because of carriers? I mean, is this genetics? Because in Malaysia, we have parents who are carriers that actually can pass on this genetic deformities to the next generations.
Yes. Yeah. So it is a genetic disease. So when the child gets it, it's actually inherited from the parents.
Do we have any statistics on how many parents or how many general populations out there are carriers that can pass this on?
We don't have a study for Malaysia, but there are studies for Pan-Asian populations. So for the Pan-Asian populations, it shows to be about 1 in 50. So if you then do 1 in 50, and I'll do it for you, Dr. George. I'll do it for you. It's 640,000.
When it warms up a minute, then I can work it out.
Sorry.
It's okay, all right, okay.
So let me tell you, and then his math is actually very, very good because he went to Chinese school.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. That's why mine isn't as good as his.
Obviously not today. Coming back to the discussion, all right, okay.
Well, 1 in 50, you said.
Yeah, so it's about 1 in 50. There might be sort of certain communities that it might be higher because there are studies which shown for Arab populations. It's even more than twice that. It's probably 1 in 20, 1 in 30.
All right.
That's because of the closeness of relationships in terms of marriage.
All right.
And the number of children. And we do maybe see that. You know, I'm going to sort of call out anecdotally, we do observe that maybe in Kelantan it might be a bit higher. That's because you're going to have large families, a closer-knit community.
Right.
And then sometimes SMA for a child, it doesn't, the symptoms don't show so early because these are the stronger types.
Mm-hmm.
So if a child sort of shows the symptoms at age 4, you might have had the family might have had another 2 kids,
mm-hmm.
right? So your incident rates might be high. And we right. do have families that have more than one child.
Yeah. Okay, so did you have a family history at all of anyone with SMA? So this is the first time.
Yeah. And that's quite typical for many rare diseases. You sort of, I didn't know, I wouldn't have thought about it. And that's why we think awareness is really important. Mm.
Did you test yourself whether you're a carrier or you have to be a carrier, right?
And
I mean, does it affect the other wider family members? You know, for example, your brothers or your cousins, would it affect them as soon as the diagnosis is made?
Yeah, it would. So if you want to focus, you probably focus around, if you're looking at prevention and carriers, around sort of, for example, families who are already at risk or, mm-hmm. you know, have someone with SMA. So my brother-in-law, you know, before he got married, did the sensible thing and said, look, I better get tested because we know it's genetic linked. And guess what? He is a carrier.
All right.
Right. But his wife isn't. So their risk of having a child with SMA, if one is not a carrier, is very, very minimal.
It's just passing the carrier genes forward, but not necessarily affect the child.
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right, then. That's interesting. We're discussing spinal muscular atrophy. We have about 640,000 Malaysian who are carriers at the moment.
Who are carriers, but show no symptoms.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you have a question for us, give us send us a WhatsApp message. It's 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. It was International Day of Disabled Persons on the 3rd of December, and we're discussing spinal muscular atrophy. Coming up next, we'll find out more about the cost of drugs. For rare diseases, we do know it can cost an arm and a leg. Most of the time, we can't afford it. Kudos to the government. They have some allocations for drugs for rare diseases. However, still not enough, I think. We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio with me, George. Mm-hmm. We're discussing spinal muscular atrophy with Edmund Lim. He's a founder of We Care Journey, also parent of Brandon with a spinal muscular atrophy. Edmund, how did you feel? I mean, how did you afford the drugs for Brandon over? I mean, Brandon is 8 years old now. How did you cope with, you know, financially as far as the cost of his drugs were concerned?
We can't get a hold of the drugs. I think that's the first thing that I need to clarify. Mm-hmm. And the drugs that can treat SMA, and what it does in terms of treating SMA is that these drugs stop the progression because SMA is a disease that deteriorates, so it stops the deterioration. We're not able to have access to the medicines in Malaysia, right?
Even with money. Is it because it's not licensed or is it because the cost is just too high?
So with money, I can buy it. Because they do have a distributor, but I can't afford it.
All right.
Right, because their pricing for a distributor price is also quite high. Mm-hmm. All orphan drugs are typically expensive because it's being made for a population which is quite small.
Tiny, yep.
Yeah, so it's going to be expensive.
Can you explain a little bit about what is the definition of orphan drug?
An orphan drug is a drug that's used to treat a rare disease. You know, and a rare disease, as a general definition, there's no universal definition, is that it's a disease that affects a small population size. Now, different countries then define what that is. So some countries may say, for example, the States is a disease that affects less than 200,000 people. In the European Union, they will say it's a disease that affects 1 in 2,000 people. Malaysia, there is no definition yet. But we know that an organization called the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society, yeah, they've proposed one, which is 1 in 4,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So how are you managing, Brendan's the progression of this disease?
You can't change the progression of the disease right now in terms of drug treatments because we don't have it. But what the protocols actually prescribe, and it's very extensive, is to manage the symptoms of the disease. With SMA, it's multidisciplinary. So we have to look after not only the neurology, mm-hmm, we have to look after the managing of his breathing, mm-hmm, we have to look after the managing of his eating, his nutrition, mm-hmm, his movement. You know, he's got orthopedic things that we've got to think about, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, hydrotherapy. You know, it's a pretty long list of things, right? Because when you think about the muscles and what it affects and you can't move, yeah, there are a lot of things that start to get affected.
I mean, before the show, I spoke to you and then I said, look, you know, you'll probably be the expert in this area, considering you don't have a medical degree. But, you know, I think comparatively to all the doctors around, you've done enough background works, you know a lot about your son and also the natural progression of the disease. I mean, can you just tell me what is a typical path a child diagnosed with SMA, what will happen in the natural progression of this disease?
The progression of the disease will depend on its severity, right? And its severity.
So it's a spectrum then?
It is a spectrum.
Okay.
So it is a spectrum. So the severity would you can see it in terms of the age of onset. So the earlier the onset, usually the more severe the progression of the disease and the more rapid the deterioration.
Is Brendan at the age of 2-3 months that actually have that floppiness? And then was that quite early in the onset?
Yes, that's quite early. Mm-hmm. However, when you look at the genetic makeup, so you can also then look at the genetic makeup. There are basically sort of four types of SMA, right? Type 1 being the most severe, where the age of onset is about 0 to 6 months. Then there's the type 2s, which are age of onset is about 7 months to about 18 months. Mm-hmm. Then type 3 is about 18 months to a couple of years. And then type 4s are sort of adult age sort of onsets. The first types, which is types 1 and 2, right, their lifespan is compromised. The severe type 1s, some of the statistics show a large percent, which is probably about 90%, don't reach the years past 2 years of age. Mm-hmm. So the spectrum is actually quite wide. So the survivability can be, you know, very slim to the, for example, the strongest one, the adults, they can still walk and they have a normal lifespan. Mm. Now, the symptoms, though, then will be severity, mm-hmm, right? It won't be that one escapes right. it, right? The biggest concern that we have is the respiratory system, mm-hmm, the muscles that we have for breathing around the ribs, called yep. the intercostal muscles, it's affected. So when it's affected, it affects the cough, the breathing is light, and that causes a lot of complications from a simple cough and cold. Mm-hmm.
So despite just the mobility, it actually is the muscle that the breathing muscles that actually will get him into trouble. Like, for example, yes. chest infection, because he can't cough out a lot of phlegms and
exactly.
he gets a chest infection on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Obviously, your wife and yourself have done extremely well. I mean, facing all these challenges, you're given the pessimistic news that, you know, the natural progression of this disease is it's not very good prognostically. But yet, you know, you managed to raise Brendan to age of 8 years old and then facing all those challenges on a daily basis. I mean, for the benefit of listeners, can you just kind of describe a few daily routine, how you raise Brendan to avoid complications of SMA?
There are very good standards which are written up in the States by panels of experts. And you can download those and you can follow it, right, as best as you can. And that's what we do, right? You follow the advice which is given and you keep him healthy. So, for example, when you're talking about, like Dr. George, when you said about cough and cold, exactly right. If you can't manage, because you can't cough, it's easy to lead to pneumonia, and that's one of the highest causes of mortality, or the highest cause of mortality for kids. Then you can think about flu vaccines, right? You can prevent it, prevent the cough and cold. And that's what we do. So that's one of the programs that we run. So these things aren't rocket science, but you have to follow it. So you have to sort of be quite disciplined to figure out, right, what needs to be done, what can be done here. We've got a machine. It's called a mechanical exhalation, insufflation machine. What it does is it blows air into his lungs and pulls it out very rapidly. So it mimics a cough, right? This machine, you know, for us has been quite a lifesaver because it helps to decongest his lungs when he's not well. In the past, it was really difficult because the only way you can probably do it is through, you know, very process called when you sort of tap his lungs and you sort of tip him over, and you know, very traumatic sort of suctioning going through the nose with a tube and trying to pull it out. Machines like that help, right? Yeah.
And you do all these at home.
Yeah, we do all that at home.
Did one of you have to give up work to look after Brandon, or you know, how have you managed that on the home front?
It's full time care.
For both of you?
For at least one, for sure. So when Brandon was diagnosed, my wife wasn't working. She couldn't work then. It was full-time care. And full-time care for her also means that I have to still chip in. So for example, in the early years, you know, he was in hospital a lot. There's just so much in terms of how my wife, Suk-Yi, can keep up with the daily thing. She needs some rest. So even when I'm working, I'll be there maybe sometimes doing the overnight shifts. And also even doing work while with him, right, in the hospital. Yeah. So the demands in terms of time is quite high.
Above that, you're running a charity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We Care Journey. As an advocate for your son's condition, Edmund, you're putting the spotlight on a father's role in the caring for children with rare diseases. Why is that? Do you see a lack of that based on the charity and the families you work with?
I think when you look at a typically Asian community, we do have some stereotypes around the man sort of goes out to work, right? The mom takes care of the home. But I think that what that ignores is the fact that raising any family, you do need the mother and the father. And we each have our own strengths. And the strengths doesn't have to be within those stereotypes. So I felt that as a father, there are certain things that I could be good at in terms of raising Brandon, in terms of his care. It's not because I'm any better or worse than Suk-Yi. It's just that each of us have different strengths.
And you complement each other. And supporting each other, because it's a difficult time, but you know, you face daily challenges and you have to overcome this together, right? I mean, obviously, behind all that, you also have the support of physicians, pediatricians, neurologists behind all that as well, because sometimes Brandon will also run into trouble, right, with chest infection and stuff. Tell us a little bit about the support that you get from the medical services.
The support that we get from PPUM, which is University Hospital, so far has been pretty good.
UMMC.
So we've worked with that crew of doctors for quite some time. They're open-minded. They work very well with us. And you know, it's really the only hospital that we know, so we can't really say much about the other hospitals. But I think with the...
And they're the original hospital that made the diagnosis and see Brandon through the journey.
No, he was diagnosed in a private private hospital.
All right.
So at the time, we had a private geneticist that got the diagnosis, but the counselling then was done with the geneticist in UMMC, and then we followed up from there on.
All right.
Okay. And recently, Maria Chin Abdullah, the Petaling Jaya Member of Parliament, met with our Deputy Health Minister, Dr. Lee Boon Chai, to urge the Ministry of Health to sort of expedite access to a new drug for spinal muscular atrophy. What was that outcome of that meeting? I mean, do you know?
Firstly, I have to thank Maria Chin for doing that. It was important for her to sort of get this table in the parliament because as much as the team, for example, when Dr. George and I were asking in terms of taking care of Brandon, were good in sort of looking after him. we also need other stakeholders from the clinical, from the community, from the Ministry of Health around access to medicines. So they're not that team from PPUM. So these would be the Ministers of Health, the Director Generals, as well as their leaders within the pediatric neurology community. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we've been trying to get in touch with them and trying to actually set, get some time from them to discuss what could be done around raising standards of care, around getting more consistent standards of care, and around preparing for access to medicines, because these medicines actually do save lives. They weren't willing to spare 5 minutes. And it was, at the end, something that we had to do to get Maria then to get attention mm-hmm. to table this. So the outcome of the tabling of the parliamentary special sessions was her, describing SMA and the challenges being faced, and then the Deputy Minister, Lee Boon Chai, replying to that. And the takeaway, as Maria has said in press, was to set up some sort of task force to look into SMA. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really crucial step, because it's something that we've been attempting to do for quite a while, but not getting the response that we wanted.
What are you championing the most? Just awareness or bringing in the drugs? What is it that you're championing?
The priority now is access to medicines.
Because you've got none at the moment, none that's accessible to you.
Yes, it's
because
not
you accessible. Can't afford it.
Yeah.
What sort of price range are you looking at in order to so that Brendan can have access to the medication?
When you're looking at price range for orphan drugs, they're going to be costly. And when you look at this drug for SMA, you're going to find a price which is publicly available in the States. However, these prices are US prices, mm-hmm. and I think that's going to be really important for the community here, especially the doctors, to not get distracted with a price which is a US price, because no one else pays that price, and we can't be making decisions based on that price alone. And with all prices for drugs, these are confidential prices that each country negotiates. Mm. And it's not going to be that price. And they're going to bundle it with all sorts of things, price caps, clawbacks, patient assistance schemes, all these sort of things to actually make it, as far as possible, sustainable in the country. So I think that's the first thing I sort of want to clarify. It's not going to be a dollar, right? It's not going to be Panadol. It's not going to be cheap in that sense. But it's not also going to be the price which they would float in the States. It's going to be somewhere in between.
So do you have any idea that, if you are pitching to the ministers and then, when they are looking at budget and see what sort of allocation they need to prepare for SMA demographic?
With 640,000 patients, carriers, I apologise. How many of them of that total would have SMA full-blown?
But you're talking about 20 to 30 per year, right?
Yes.
Children. So, if the ministry were to calculate what sort of budget, because there were some allocations on funds to specific group that you may have access to. And also, would that be sufficient?
Okay. So, sort of
two questions.
Yeah. Firstly, when you look at sort of carriers, that's not affected.
Yep.
You're looking at the people who are affected by SMA. And there's sort of two things you've got to think about. One is incidence, which is the number born with, and prevalence, which is the number still surviving.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. When you're looking at incidence, it's that number, which is at least 1 in 20,000. So we believe, though, the figure in Malaysia should be maybe 1 in 11,000. You're looking at close to maybe 1 a week. The first question to ask is, are we able to find all these patients? Because we're not sure yet, right? So we don't know whether it's going to be, a kid a week. Last year, there were 6 that were diagnosed. In the third quarter of the year, we lost all of them, except for one. So it's hard to say. I think statistically, we sort of can expect that sort of figure. Prevalent population, though, we have 40-plus right now patients a day. However, they're mostly the stronger types of SMA. They're more of the older types. So the young and the weak type 1s and type 2s really are a very, very small number. For drugs, which like for Spinraza or Nusinersen, which treats SMA, we have to think about, are we going to try to treat everybody like Japan? And if you're going to be resource constrained, which we are, then we have to think about, what's the right sort of ethical model, right medical model to approach the situation, right? How do we determine the ones which are most at risk and most receptive and most, you know, to gain from getting access to these medicines. Mm-hmm. And these are decisions that, you know, a lot, you know, people need to make, and the medical community needs to make together with policyholders on how we can sort of roll out the scheme. If you think we're going to start with a scheme which is going to take care of everything, I think that's not going to happen. Yeah. But the point is to start. And when you're thinking about the budget, which Dr. George sort of asked us now, so what budget would that possibly look like? I think the easiest way to think about this, if assuming the 50 million was split equally, you know, for the five different causes, and therefore rare disease gets one. Now, that 10 million is the same as 10 million, which is there last year. To sort of think about whether that fund should cover for more things, I think it's going to be a bit unreasonable. In the sense that, you know, you can't just spread it out further and still do the same. What that fund needs to do is to expand and then extend, right, to cover SMA. So say if you double it, you know, another 10 million, could 10 million make a difference? It's going to be, again, hard for me to say what the price is going to be because all these prices are negotiated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I would personally right now sort of put my sort of foot out and say, you know, I think if you started with that, you probably might be able to cater for all the at-risk kids of type 1 and type 2 in Malaysia today, mm-hmm. right? Biogen was in town. Right, so they have been in town the last 3 days. We just caught up with them recently. They're very receptive, right, to wanting to do something in Malaysia.
Who are they? Could you explain to us?
Biogen's the company, the pharmaceutical company that provides this drug that stops SMA, okay. that treats SMA. They're working within the Asian region and are looking to work with policymakers, right, with funders to find ways to actually see what can be done for the country.
Yeah, but cost-wise, it's just not all about the... I mean, it is the drugs, of course, takes a huge chunk. But, you know, you need financial support for everything else, Edmund, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a very multidisciplinary sort of condition where he needs orthopedic care and you know, everything, respiratory physicians perhaps looking at him, all sorts. And all of that costs a lot of money as well.
Yeah, and when you think of costs as well, there's things that unitary cost. So sometimes, of course, people get distracted with a per-person price.
Yeah.
And they think that that's going to be one that's going to put the health system at risk. It's mm-hmm. actually not, because the population size is small. Mm-hmm. So you think of, let's say, 10 million, for example, that's not even a rounding error of the whole healthcare budget of 28 billion,
yes.
right? So in the whole scheme of things, I think if you sort of keep looking at a unitary price, that might be sort of like a red herring. Where the healthcare system strains is expensive drugs for large population groups. And that's when probably Malaysia's had to look at things like HIV, mm-hmm. or Hep C, and why we had to sort of go down the path of compulsory licenses.
Yep.
Because these are the ones that really burden the system. When you sort of think about rare diseases, yes, it may look expensive per patient, but it's about the equity and the equality of, you know, that everyone sort of not to be left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And to think about it from a financial perspective, a slightly different way.
Okay, we're discussing spinal muscular atrophy in view of International Day of Disabled Persons on the 3rd of December. I can see George sort of getting a little lost in this conversation. George, are you lost? He's been very quiet, I can tell. Dr. George Lee joining me
He's looking very
intense.
You know, Edmund obviously went through a journey of 8 years,
yep.
and I'm just overwhelmed with your endeavor. You knew a lot about
so much passion,
here.
Isn't it?
Exactly.
I know.
We need to hear a little bit more about this afterwards.
Yes, coming up next after the market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasodi. The 3rd of December was International Day of Disabled Persons, and so we're discussing a rare disease mm-hmm. called spinal muscular atrophy. Joining us today, Edmund Lim, the founder of We Care Journey, and he's also a parent of a child with spinal muscular atrophy, and of course, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist with me, trying to carry through this conversation where Edmund knows so much.
Yeah, I know.
We're just like listening, so much passion, all those numbers and... You know, genetic.
He knows his stuff.
Yeah, he does. He does. You know, don't argue, George.
That's right. Exactly. I just agree.
So, you know, Budget 2019, you mentioned very briefly just now, Edmund, but Budget 2019 has promised 50 million for five areas.
Mm-hmm.
Among them, rare diseases, others being hepatitis C, stunted growth, hemodialysis treatments, and enhanced primary health care. But assuming rare diseases gets an equal share, which is about 10 million, Do you think it will be? How do you think it will be best spent? So it's given to you. How will you use that money? Let's just say.
How would I use it?
I mean, if you were given and you run this WeCare journey, and if you were given that hat, you know, okay, here, rare diseases, 10 million. Well, how will you manage that money? Because there are other rare diseases as well.
Yeah. And I think that's a big challenge because any fund which you receive, you know, has to be distributed or used in a way which is, you know, with equality, right? Mm-hmm. And with some sort of equity. 10 million is, it would look like the carryover of the fund from last year.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I could use it, I wouldn't, because I know that there are already people and there are already patients with rare conditions.
Let's say it's exclusively allocated for SMA. How do you think it should be distributed in usage? Because the drug is one part of it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the daily care is another huge part of this. And the carer needs some attention and fund as well, because you have the luxury of, I use the word in air quotes, the luxury of being able to be completely full-time looking after Brendan. But many parents won't be able to have that sort of like a ability financially to do that. So how do you think it's best spent for this money if it's just all allocated for
if
SMA?
If it's just for SMA, I would look at using it for the drug first.
Okay.
Right? Because what happens with the drug is it will offset costs in other areas of the system.
Agreed.
Right. If you think about it from Brandon's point of view, the amount of physiotherapy care that he needs, right, we can't even get that of anywhere close to sufficient from the public hospitals because they just don't have the capacity. So we have to source, you know, from privately as well and pay privately. When you're looking at hospitalizations, if you don't have if you don't intervene with the right medicines early enough, your hospitalizations are going to be high. The stays are going to be long, and that takes a lot of cost, right? Mm-hmm. Not only from the infrastructure, but also from the services and from all the other supportive medications that's actually required. So you will have an offset, but you won't see the offset immediately. But I think if you sort of dedicate around treating kids early enough so that they don't suffer with all these complications from SMA and its progression, you're going to save costs elsewhere as well, which you might not see immediately, but there will be an offset.
I don't know whether you can answer this question. Is that how effective is this drug, and how long is the effectiveness seems to be
helping
evident,
with helping the, which slowing down the progression?
Like any drug, it's a bell curve.
Okay,
right. All drugs are the same. Right. You're going to have ones which are highly receptive. You're going to have people or patients who are non-receptive, and then you're going to have, you know, a big sort of majority in the middle. So it's hard to say, because there would be patients who won't be receptive.
Because there won't be many trials done, because the number is so small.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And then so what is a kind of typical lifespan of the effectiveness of this drug? For how long does it be useful for SMA sufferers?
So with this current drug that's approved, it's called Spinraza, it's to be taken lifelong. Right. It's to be taken lifelong. For the videos or some of the videos that you see around the kids, and you would probably think that these are the kids who are responding very well to the drugs. It's like a typical child.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, we don't see, of course, the cases, but we do know this data, which actually shows their children who don't respond as well.
Yeah.
Now, what that eventually is going to be from a Malaysian perspective is exactly what Dr. George said, which is you don't have enough data yet.
Mm-hmm.
So as part of this, you know, process of now the drugs rolling out, and it's rolling out to 30 over countries, I think there's going to be a lot more learning to be done. And I think Biogen's aware there's a lot more that's going to be learnt over the course of the use of the medicine.
Let's talk about gene testing. Is it costly to actually get your gene test for SMA?
There is a subsidized way to do it, which will then be quite cheap. So there's the testing facility called IMR. And if you get it tested through, let's say, HKL, it can be subsidized. And I believe that price is going to be probably about in the range of 200 to 300.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You can also get it tested privately, or you can test it privately locally or overseas. That will usually typically cost about 1,000 upwards. We are trying, under at least our organization, to work with some of these testing labs overseas to see whether we can find, you know, a way to bring that cost down.
Okay. Because, you know, if you want family members to go and check as well, then, you know, it will be more accessible to everyone when one person is diagnosed to actually see if you're a carrier or not. And that's the only way you're going to know how many people, how many more people we actually have out there who are carriers, isn't it? It's probably much more than 640,000 at the moment that you know of. So Professor Tong wrote in The Star recently that the Ministry of Health has established a technical committee to evaluate applications for rare disease treatments. Now, why is it important to sort of expedite approval for these orphan drugs? Could you just tell me a little bit more about Professor Tong and the article?
To expedite approval?
Yeah.
You don't have other choices. So with rare diseases, you have no choice, right? I think with other diseases, because it also affects a wider population pool, you've got to be a lot more careful, but you also would have other options. For example, with cancer, you're going to have chemotherapy as an option. You're going to have a lot of other targeted therapies as an option. So it's important that, of course, that's to be safe. But when you look at orphan drugs, let's say for SMA, and when the kid's born maybe 1 week, and if they're also severe, their lifespan could be a matter of months. So if you're going to take a long, long time to
get robust data, you can rely,
however, on the data that's actually available for many other countries. So there's a bit of a balance in terms of acceleration for orphan drugs, simply because the prognosis and what happens to the patient is going to be pretty severe and pretty rapid, and there's no other option.
Okay. So tell me, what are you going to do with We Care Journey? How are you going to provide this support and how has that come along so far?
What we provide in We Care Journey is built across sort of four pillars. And the four pillars are called care. But it's really sort of two groups of things.
Okay.
The first group is around family support and empowerment. So with family support and empowerment, we focus on three things, which is really trying to get as much information out to families as well as the wider community in terms of how to take care, in terms of the standards of care for SMA.
So effective like a patient support group?
Yeah, it's a patient support group. But providing information. So we've got the first care guide, which is adopted from the International Standards of Care in Malay. So it's going to be a lot more accessible, a lot more usable for the community. We also provide equipment that looks at protecting the health of the patients. It can be flu vaccines. So we've got a flu vaccine program, or highly expensive specialized equipment like the MEI machines, suction machines and other things. We provide that at nominal cost or at no cost. So sort of teaching them, people learning how to care for an SMA child better, being able to protect the health of the child better. And the last one is around empowering. So things like powered wheelchairs, we provide powered wheelchairs, we provide sort of standing frames so that they can maintain their bone health. So that's sort of family support and empowerment. The other group of work that we do is all around advocacy and awareness. Now, awareness is so key, right? Without awareness, because rare diseases, there's so many. If a doctor sort of sees a child which is slow in progression, a floppy, we would want them to have at the top of their mind, oh, this could be SMA.
Yeah.
That really then speeds up the ability to get a diagnosis. And with the right diagnosis, you can start intervention, proper intervention, early intervention. So awareness is really important. And what we're doing right now, which is advocacy, trying to work with stakeholders from the government to explain to them, this is a situation and these are things that we can do. And this is how the stakeholders we see should be working together. So there are many stakeholders. So what we're trying to do as well is trying to be that glue that pulls the stakeholders together. Otherwise, you're going to have pharma companies waiting for the government to act, waiting for the doctors to act, waiting for, you know, if no one's going to make a move, then we're going to want to sort of draw people in and try to get them round the table to talk about, you know, how can we sort of get to the outcomes that we're all interested in.
Okay, how do we get in touch with you, Edmund? Is there a website or an email address?
There's a website. It's We Care Journey. So WeCareJourney.org. On the website, you can find our contact details for emails and phone numbers.
Okay, fantastic. Well, wish you all the best. So passionate. I mean, I hope, you know, people in Ministry of Health listen to you now, and we'll send them the podcast so they'll at least understand SME a lot better. If they haven't already, I'm sure they have. But, you know, just to listen to, you know, your case and how you feel about things will be helpful, I think.
Thank you so much, Mira. Thank you, Dr.
Welcome.
George, for having me.
You're
here.
Welcome. George, you have a message.
You know, in medical school, you're always taught one thing, to say that in order to make a disease worthwhile screening and treating for, you need to know several things. Number one, you need to know that it's common enough, it needs to know it's important enough, disease burden, and then also how it affects the general population. Today, I learned something very differently, because what you gave is a rare disease a voice. You gave it a voice because that is that minority that really didn't have a voice. And what you did is give it a voice because, obviously, of the journey that you went through and the passion that you have. And one word that actually stuck in my mind is that you're fighting for that equity. Mm-hmm. And I really think I wish you all the best. And I really think that equity hopefully will come to Brendan and the rest of the children who deserve them.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you both very much for joining us today. Edmund Lim, founder of We Care Journey, and as well as Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in our Doctor in the House series on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.